Please take your Bibles out and turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. We'll begin tonight in verse 5 and verse 6. We're looking at contrast of adversity, suffering, and sin. And we're looking at some couplets that are in these passages in order to explain some truths that are contained in the mind of God. We left off this morning discussing the subject of a sad countenance and of sorrow. Tonight we want to pick it up in verse 5 and verse 6. It is better to hear the rebuke of a wise than a man to hear the song of fools. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool. This also is vanity. Surely oppression destroys a wise man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. The end of a thing is better than the beginning. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Now in these passages, he's using and emphasizing the word better. It's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than the songs of fools. And the reason of that is because there can be benefit. If someone hears the rebuke of the wise, it's something that can be corrected and some benefit can be derived. That's not the same in the song of a fool. Many do not like to be shown their sin and error. Why? Because they don't want to change. They don't want to learn to do better. They don't want to do better. And so when you point it out to them, it does nothing but make them more angry. We often see this truth contained when we talk to people who differ with us on religious issues. Instead of looking open-mindedly and examining the Bible, examining the text, they get upset. They get mad. You can also see this in life when you have to go and correct sin in people's life. When you have to go and point out things that they need to correct, they get angry. Why? Because they don't like to be corrected. They don't like to be rebuked. It's kind of a natural reaction. Some even despise those who point it out. They try to destroy the messenger. One of the greatest examples of this is in the New Testament, what they did to our Lord. When our Lord pointed out the hypocrisy of the Pharisees and showed that they made their traditions more valuable and more important than law, what did they do? They tried to destroy him. Instead of correcting their behavior, instead of acknowledging that he was right, that they hadn't been merciful, they hadn't been just in their dealing with their fellow man, instead of doing that, they sought out to discredit him. And when that didn't work, then they sought out to destroy him. Why? Because they did not want to be corrected. They were very much high-minded and thought that they knew better than the Lord did. Songs of fools. The praise and flattery of fools are senseless and useless and void of any spiritual benefit. The Bible warns us in the book of Proverbs about someone that says nothing but good about you. You better back up and you better think about that. Flattery is setting you up for something that can be very unprofitable and very demonstrative in your life. You see, it's senseless and useless because there's no spiritual benefit. You know, if you just praise and you just ignore the wrong and you don't deal with the wrong and you don't correct the wrong, there is no spiritual benefit in that. It may sound more pleasant for people to build you up and to flatter you, but if you have things in your life that need to be corrected, then they really don't love you and it's not going to have any spiritual profit. And so there are things that are better. Now, he uses the illustration of thorns and twigs under a pot that burns. If you know anything about that, they make a good fire. They're kind of something you can start a fire with, and they burn and they crackle and they make a lot of noise. But the problem is they don't give off any heat. And so if you're building a fire for heat and you do it with thorns and twigs, you're going to hear a lot of crackling. It's going to burn real easy, but it's not going to give you any benefit because there's no heat provided. Likewise, the laughter of a fool is loud, but it's meaningless and has no lasting value because it does not help us or it does not help us to be better. And so it just makes a lot of noise, but there is no benefit. Again, this is showing the illustration of the emptiness of earthly pursuits. Again, remember what Solomon is looking for. He's looking for the meaning of life. He's looking for what has lasting, enduring quality. What can help us? What can encourage us? What can edify us? And so what he's doing, he's showing the emptiness of pursuing things strictly from a physical and a earthly pursuit vantage point. And he said that by itself can be unprofitable for us. Association with the wise makes us better. In Psalms chapter 141 and verse number 5. Psalms 141 and verse number 5. This is a very reoccurring theme in the Psalms and in the Proverbs. It says in verse number 5, I remember the days of old. I meditate on all your works. I muse on the work of your hands. Again, I'm looking at the wrong verse. 141 and verse 5. I'm sorry. Let the righteous strike me, and it shall be kindness. And let him rebuke me. It shall be an excellent oil. Let my head not refuse it. Again, the psalmist is saying that when I'm rebuked, when it's necessary, there's good that comes from that, and there's profit that comes from that. We also see this same truth in some of the Proverbs. We'll just read one of these. In Proverbs chapter 9 and verse number 8. Proverbs chapter 9 and verse number 8. Do not correct a scoffer, lest he hate you. Rebuke a wise man, and he will love you. Give instruction to a wise man, he will be wiser. Teach a just man, and he will increase in learning. There's lots of truth in this, and we know this by human observation. People that associate with people who are wise and people who have insight, they can make us better. They can make us more wise. They can help us make better decisions. They can help us make better choices. And again, if you make a spiritual application of this passage, if you look to the wisdom of God and the divine wisdom of God and His Word, it will make you a better person. You'll make better decisions. You'll make better choices. And when you associate with people that are wise, it shows wisdom on your part. You know, oftentimes people, when they compare themselves and when they're trying to build themselves up, they put themselves beside somebody in their eyes that's weaker and somebody that's not as affluent as they are, or maybe someone who has more problems than they do. And so they try to build themselves in that way. Well, that's really counterproductive. It's better to look to someone who is wise, someone who can help you grow, someone that can help you become better, and someone can help you do a better job in your life. That's where real wisdom is shown in the kind of people we put around us. He says the wise cannot understand why people oppress one another. Well, they do that because of greed. They do that because of selfishness. But there's a lot of reasons why people oppress one another. And again, it's usually for selfish motives. Bribery debases one's heart. And what it does, it shows your character. A person that can be bribed is someone that cannot be trusted. It's somebody that has no integrity. It's somebody that has a debased mind. They would pass on justice simply in order to profit by it. Good people don't like to receive gifts that they don't deserve. You know, people will do good things for you, and they don't want to be repaid. They don't want you to do anything for them. That's not why they do it. They do it out of the goodness of their heart. They do it because they care, because they're concerned, and because they have the ability to do it. Those accepting bribes know in their hearts that they're hypocrites. They know that, but they don't care because they're only worried with the end result. They're only worried by the profit that they gain for themselves. Bribery displays corruption. If someone would take a bribe, would that be somebody you would trust? Is that somebody whose character shows corruption, shows a flaw in it? Surely it does. Bribery and oppression bring a response. And usually the kind of response it brings is a negative response. You're not going to trust somebody who would take a bribe. You're not going to put confidence in somebody that takes a bribe because he has a corrupt character. Let me give you a biblical illustration. Remember why, when Eli was older, then the people decided that they no longer wanted judges. And one of the things that they told Samuel is because his son did not walk in his way. Eli, he didn't restrain his son. But that wasn't said about Samuel. Samuel wasn't given a rebuke because he didn't restrain his sons, but his sons did not walk in the ways of their father, and they did not want to follow him. They were oppressive. They had no confidence in him. Now, that really was an underlying reason. The real reason that they wanted a king was to be like the nations around about them. But, again, they didn't have any confidence in a person that doesn't have honesty and is not just. And it's oppressive. People like that have no integrity. And if they don't, you don't have any confidence in them. And there are Things that are better, people that are wise, people that are just, people that are honest, people that have integrity. Those are the kind of people we have more confidence in, we have more trust in. And even everyday life tells us that, and Solomon is just reinforcing it. He also says that the end of a thing is better than the beginning. And probably the greatest biblical examples of that are Joseph and Job. Look at all that Joseph went through. He was sold into slavery by his brothers. He was separated from his father and his family for 17 years. He was thrown in jail because he did the right thing. He was mislied about. He was misled. And in all of this, Job could have gave up his faith, but he didn't. He stuck with God. He did what was right. And every situation he found himself in, he prospered in it because he never forgot his faith. He never lost faith in God. And even at the end of Job's life, when his father Israel dies, and now the brothers say, now he's going to take vengeance. Now he's going to get even with me. But he didn't do that. He told them in Genesis chapter 50, he said, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, to send me ahead to preserve life. You see, Job looked at the good that at the end, even after all of his struggles, he understood the good that his life produced. What about Job? Look at the terrible beginning that Job had. In the beginning, he served God, he was respected, he was loved, people admired him, and the Satan said, you got a hedge around him. But you take away all that he has, and he'll reject you, he'll rebuke you, he'll curse you to your face. And God allowed him to do that. And after he did it, Job didn't give up. He didn't give up his faith. Matter of fact, if you read in Job chapter 1, you read that after he lost all of his prosperity, lost all 10 of his children, even in chapter 2, his wife will tell him to curse God and God. And after all of that he went through on a personal basis, it says he went to God and he worshiped him. He never gave up his faith. Now, he had a lot of questions. And he thought if he could ever get an audience with God, that he could make everything right. Well, you know what? He got what he asked for. He got an audience with God. And when he got an audience with God, he understood how insignificant he was to question God. He was in no position to question the things that God did. But what happened at the end of Job's life? He became more wealthy than he was in the beginning, and he received more children in abundance. But again, did Job know that when he was going through all of his trial and his tribulation? No. Was he guaranteed that? No. But he never gave up his faith. And so the end of a thing is better than the beginning. Better to look back on accomplishment than on a new project. It's better to look on the good that we've done than to dwell upon a failure or something that we were not able to accomplish. He talks about patience. Patient in spirit is better than a proud in spirit. Surely it's better to be patient than to be haughty and to be arrogant. There's much more profit that can come in your life by being patient and learning patience. It's a virtue. It's one of the things that God says that we need to add to our faith. It's something that can help us. Good to get things done than have anxiety that it is gone. Instead of worrying about what happens to it, it's better to get things done than to worry about it not being accomplished. Patience enables us to grow. Remember what James 4 says, when we're tempted, we are to endure it patiently. In 1 Peter chapter 5, in verse number 5, the Apostle Peter, in his first epistle, wrote in the fifth verse of the fifth chapter, he said, Likewise, you younger people, submit yourself to the elders. Yes, all of you be submissive one to another and be clothed with humility. And in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 5, it is one of the virtues that we are to add to our faith. If we're to add virtue to virtue, knowledge to knowledge, self-control. That's patience. We are to add patience. It is better to be patient. It enables you to grow. And so there are things better because of what they produce. What these passages mean is there are actions and attitudes that are more beneficial, more productive, more helpful to us because they end with better results. And even life teaches us that truth. Now let's look at verses 9 and 10. It says, do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. Do not say, why were the former days better than these? for you do not inquire wisely concerning this. We should not hasten to be angry. Anger rests in the bosom of fools. The Bible tells us in Ephesians 4 and verse 26 that we must control our emotions. It says, be angry and sin not. And then verse 27 says, don't let the sun go down on your wrath, because when you do, you give place to the devil. In James chapter 1, it tells us to be slow to speak, slow to anger. We need to have our emotions in control. When you let anger control you, it controls your actions. It controls what you do. And whatever you do will not be productive. What happens when we get into a discussion and we become angry? What's the most important thing? We want to win the argument. And we figure the louder we go and the longer we yell, that we'll win the argument. But you see, that's counterproductive. It doesn't accomplish anything. And so we need to rein our emotion in. And we need to try to be level-headed. And we need to be in control of what we think. It can be used as an advantage to combat sin and error. Or it can be used to your own destruction. Do you understand that if you are unable to control your emotions, it can in time destroy your character? It can bring a lot of hardship into your life. It can bring a lot of heartache into your life. But it can be a very great blessing if we can learn to control how we react when we are misled or when we are mistreated. If we learn how to react in a positive way, in a good way, then it can be very productive and it can be very, very, very beneficial to us. Anger not controlled quickly becomes part of one's character. You ever heard people say, he's got a short fuse? What does that mean? That means he can't control his anger. Let me share something with you tonight. I come from a family that has a lot of short fuses. My father was one that had a very short fuse. And I tried very hard when I was growing up to tell myself that I didn't want to be like that when I grew up. Well, you know, I saw long enough that some of it rubbed off on me. And when I was very early in my life, in my 20s, in my early teens, my late teens, my early 20s, I was very much had a temper where I would get fly off the handle and I would not control my emotions. And it began to bother me that why this was continually happening to me, why I thought everybody was lighting my fuse. Well, you know what happened? I finally figured it out. I finally figured out that who was lighting the fuse was not them, it was me. And when I quit lighting the fuse, they didn't have any fun doing it anymore, and they left me alone. And I learned that when I control my emotions, and they didn't get the reaction they wanted, then they didn't bother me, and they seemed to happen less and less. And that's been true to this day. Now, you know what? It takes time to make a habit. But if you make it, you can break it. And you just have to take the right steps. And again, this is where patience comes in. Where if we learn to control our anger, it will help us in forming a good character. If you don't, then you're going to be in for a lot of heartache in your life, and you're going to be able not to handle situations because your emotion is going to lead instead of common sense and reason. Looking back at the good old days. What are the good old days? You know, I hear people talk about that. You hear my grandparents talk about that. They talk about the good old days when they had to walk to get water, when they had to go outside to use the restroom, when they had to walk miles and miles for anything they do, where they worked and got 10 cents an hour or less, or 5 cents an hour, and they worked from dusk till dawn, and they call that the good old days. You know, I can remember as a young man listening to that, and I thought, I don't see what the good old days are all about. That sounds pretty bad to me, because I live in the age of luxury where I can flip on a switch and turn on a light, and I got running water and I got electricity, and I think I got all these advantages. How could that be better? Brother, what it means looking back on the good old days, it's reminiscing something we left that is better left than remembered. But there's something, if we continually look back on something that we left, that's something we needed to leave, then there's a problem. Because our mind's in the wrong place. Every age has its bright and dark side, doesn't it? You know, I do think there was some good in those days. You know why? Because I think it taught you the value of hard work. It taught you accountability. It taught you that you had to take care of yourself. There was many good things that came from that period of time. But we have a tendency to forget the evil of the past, and we think they were better. You know, sometimes we think about the good old days, but we forget about the bad old days that were with them too. And we just kind of focus our mind on the good and we forget the bad. Well, you know what? That's not wise. You know what? When I was in the world and lived in the world, there were things that I did that I thought were fun, that I thought brought me a lot of enjoyment. But when I look back on it, and when I really think about it, and when I think about what it brought into my life, I don't miss a one of them. Because there are things that are more profitable to do with your life. You know what that's called? That's called wisdom. That's called growth. And we need to be careful that we don't dwell in the past, that we hinder our future. Make the best of the situation now. In every one of our lives, living in the past is foolishness. There's only one thing you should do with the past. Learn from it. We all made mistakes. You know, if we could rearrange our lives, if we could erase some things, wouldn't we do it? Aren't there some things in our lives that if we could erase them as if they never happened, we never did them, we would all do that. But again, we can learn from those things, but don't dwell on them. Don't let them destroy your future because you can never forget it. That's one of the things that we have to understand about forgiveness. When God forgives something, there's no use of revisiting it. There's no use of going over it again. It's done. It's past. Move forward. You know what? Living in the past can cause you to give up on the present. You remember what Jesus said in Luke 9:62? He said, the man that looks back is not fit for the kingdom of heaven. You can't look about what you left. You have to press forward. And that's what Philippians 3. In Philippians 3, Paul was writing a letter that sometimes is referred to as a letter of joy. And in this, he commended the Philippians, and he used himself as an example. He said in verse 13, he said, brethren, I do not count myself as apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things that are ahead. You know, when Paul became a Christian, he left a lot of personal benefits. He was respected in the religious hierarchy of the day. He was very prominent. He was very well respected. He was very well known. And he was very educated. And he very much had things his way. But when he became a Christian, his life became very difficult. Read 2 Corinthians 11. His life became one of very much tribulation and tribulation. But when he looked back at the end of his life, he didn't have any regrets. He didn't think about the past. He just thought about the future. And that's how we need to live our life. Learn from the past, but don't dwell on the past. Because it can hinder your future. And it can hinder the present. Verse 11 and 12. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, and profitable to those who see the sun. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. But the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. Wisdom is a good thing with inheritance. Wealth misused brings a lot of unhappiness, doesn't it? You know, that's why people that win the lottery, it doesn't always change their life for the better, does it? It often destroys their life. Why? Because they don't have the wisdom how to use it. They don't have the wisdom how to appreciate it. You know, you can have a lot of wealth and it can destroy your life in many ways. Because you don't have the wisdom in how to use it in a way that benefits you, a way that benefits others, and a way that doesn't destroy your relationship with God. You know, the Bible has a lot to say about wealth and money and greed and covetousness. The New Testament has many passages that warn us about that. Why does the New Testament emphasize that so much? Because it's an ever-present danger. You've got to understand, it's not wrong to have wealth. It's not wrong to have things. It's not wrong to have possessions. But it is wrong if it controls your life. If it controls your life, then it's a problem. Because it's going to destroy the good things in your life in time. And Solomon says, it's okay to have an inheritance, to be left something. But he says, if you don't have the wisdom and how to use it, then it can bring unhappiness in your life. And again, we have observation and experience that tells us the truth in that. The spiritual inheritance of instruction in divine wisdom is the best given or received. The thing I want to leave my children, more than I want to leave anything else, is a spiritual inheritance. I want to leave them with a life of knowing the need for God in their life. That's more important than anything else I could ever give them. Because that will outlive me. That will outlive them if they use it in the right way. Endures giving the best counsel. What benefit from our wisdom? It gives us balance. It guards us from one extreme to the other. If you have wisdom, and your wisdom is rooted in divine wisdom, it gives your life balance. And you don't go from one extreme to the other. It gives you strength. It keeps you stable. We use the term, it makes us even keeled. It keeps us in a spiritual balance. It gives us insight. You know, I think I have better insight today than I did when I was 20. And I think I have better insight today than when I was 40. I think I have better insight because I know what is valuable because I've learned by experience, I've learned by observation, and I've also learned by the mistakes that I've made. And so I believe I have better insight today, and I believe my wisdom is greater today than it was many, many years ago when I was young. You know, I often told you there was a time when I thought my parents, they weren't very wise, and I thought I knew better than them. And it was amazing when I turned 21 years old and I was been in the military for about 3 years and I began to reflect on my life and I found out that my parents weren't as foolish as I thought they were. And what they did, if my parents didn't change, I grew up. And I understood the value of their counsel and of the wisdom. Because much of the counsel that I got as a young man didn't come from them, it came from God. They counseled me in things that they got from God. And those things are still with me to this day. Those things will follow me to my grave. Those are things and wisdom that I got from my parents that I still use to this very day. And that's what I want to leave my children. That's what I want to leave my grandchildren. I want to leave them wisdom and counsel that will outlive them, that they can pass down to their children. Practical. You know, we need to learn how to live life practically. Everyday living. There's good and there's bad. There's ups and there's downs. There's times when it's good, there's times when it's bad. There's times when things don't work out as you plan, and you have to be practical about it. You can't allow yourself to get too extreme one way or the other. Because if you do, it's going to end badly. Wisdom and money are a defense. How? Defense means a method of defending or resisting. There's power in money. Who would deny that? Sure, there's power in money. There's also power in wisdom. Excellence of knowledge. You know, in this text, wisdom in chapter 7 is used 13 times. In 13 different ways, Solomon talks about wisdom. And in every one of the passages that he gives about wisdom, he says that it gives life. The right kind of wisdom. The wisdom that is founded in spiritual things gives benefit. It preserves and it makes better. Money can build you a fortress, but wisdom can protect you without the money and can still give you a fortress. You know, there's things that money can buy and there's things that money can never buy. Money can't buy and make you smarter. Oh, you can get educated. You can get an education, you get a college education, and you can learn secular wisdom, but that won't mean that you're smarter. That won't mean that you have good... Have you ever known people who are very educated, but have no common sense? Have you met people like that? I know you have. You see, money can't do everything for you. And so money is good if it's used properly. But if it's used improperly, it brings heartache and misery and problems. Wisdom from God is the best kind of wisdom. It is the wisdom that works. It's the wisdom that's been tested. It's the wisdom that's been tried. And it's the wisdom that will outlive any of us. And it's the best type of wisdom. And that's what Solomon's going to find out when he gets to the end of the book. Now, the end of the chapter 7. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed one as well as the other, so that a man can find out nothing that will come after him. I have seen everything in my days of vanity. There is a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. And he calls that vanity. Now, he says, consider the works of God. Who can make straight what God has made crooked? There's not one thing that God has determined in his wisdom that you, me, or anyone else can change. There's some things that God determined before time began, and not any of the wisdom of the world cannot change one of those things. God has set the standard, and man cannot alter the basic structure. God's ways should not be tampered with. You know what he says in Isaiah 5, verse 20? Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. Do we live in those times today? When men have flipped and turned and called what is good evil and called what is evil good, God says that's foolishness. And you know what? Man can give it any name he wants to. Let me give you an illustration. Man can tell us in his wisdom that a certain path and a certain attitude can get you and gain you much in this life. But if God says that path and that way will lead you to destruction, nothing a man does will change that. God says it's appointed a man wants to die. After death comes the judgment. You can't alter that. I can't alter that. No man in life can alter that. Jesus said, unless you believe that I am he, you will die in your sin. No matter what man thinks about Jesus, no matter if he ever converts to Christianity, no matter if he ever has a relationship to Christ, he will not change one meaning of what that says. If a man does not believe in Christ and doesn't have Christ in his life, he will die lost. And nothing that man can do can change that. Nothing. God made some things that man doesn't have the ability to change. And you know what? We need to know that because God is supreme. Who's dependent on who? Who needs who? You know, in Acts 17, Paul made the argument to a bunch of idolaters in Athens. He says, we don't worship God because he's in need of anything. We don't give God life, breath. We don't do that for God. All the things that we do for God doesn't add one thing to God's life. It's not us that he needs. We need him. In him we live and move and have our being. It's not the other way around. You know, we have people in our country who think it's their lifelong ability and their aim is that they're going to preserve this world. We're not going to let men destroy this world. Let me let you in on a secret. God created this world to destroy a little at a time. God never intended this planet to last forever. That's not why he created it. He didn't create it for an eternity. He created it for man to inhabit for as long as man lived upon it. And according to Genesis 1, who did he give to have dominion over that? He created it for man. Who did he give dominion of that world to? He gave it to man. Now, that doesn't mean that man should misuse it. That doesn't mean that he shouldn't appreciate it. And it doesn't mean that he can't destroy it, and he's done that, and he continues to do that. But ladies and gentlemen, it is blasphemous to worry about killing seals and not give one thought to killing a baby in a womb. You've got things backwards. We're more worried about the trees and the animals than we are about human life. That has things back. It goes back to Isaiah 5. Calling something that is good evil and calling something evil good. Brethren, man cannot change it. He thinks he can. He thinks he can change it and make it better, but he cannot. Name me one thing that God has determined that if man changed it, it would be better. There is not one thing you could think of that if we change it, we can make it better than God. There are serious consequences when we try to bend God's will. And you know what? We see this every day. We see this every day in the world of religion. Where men are bending the will of God. They're changing it. They're altering. They're amending it in order to fit the times. Is it making it better? No, it's not making it better. It's making it worse. You know why? Because it's focused on who? It's not focused on God. It's focused on them. How does that make it better? God wants to do what's best for all of us. Not what's best for some of us. He wants to do what's best for all of us. And so we need to appreciate that if we change God's ways and we alter them, there are serious, serious consequences. If there was one lesson that I wish that I could be successful in teaching my fellow men who are religious, is how do they believe in their heart that they can change God's law without there being a consequence to that? I really don't understand how they can really in their heart believe that. That they can alter God's law, that they can change and give it a different meaning and do it a different way and in the same breath claim that they love God. That's hypocrisy. That's hypocrisy, and it has serious consequences. The day of prosperity and adversity. There are going to be days that are good. There are going to be plans that you make, and they work out the way that you thought they would. And you're going to have a lot of good days. But along with those good days, you're going to have some adversity. You're going to have some things you didn't plan on. You're going to have some things that didn't go the way that you thought they should go. You're going to have some heartache. You're going to have some unhappiness. It's going to happen. It's part of life. It's a package deal. God causes both bad and good as part of life's experience. It's a package deal. You know when the Bible says that it rains on the just and the unjust? You know, if you read the Psalms and you read the Proverbs, you know one of the things the psalmist had a great deal of difficulty in? The prosperity of the wicked. How can the wicked who has no account for God, has no desire to serve God, just lives for himself, just does what he wants, doesn't when he wants, how he wants, doesn't regard anyone but himself, but he seems to prosper, and the person who's trying to live for God, he seems to struggle. That just seems unfair, doesn't it? That just seems kind of out of kilter, doesn't it? It depends on how you look at it. There's always going to be people who are evil that are going to benefit. That's just part of the equation of living here in life. But the truth is, there's a price to pay for that. There's a hidden cost that they're not thinking about. So man can find out nothing after him. That's what Job concluded. In Job, we received the good from God. Will we not receive the adversity? We have to answer that question. God has the key to everything. Learn the lessons on contentment. You know how you cannot allow? You know what I talked to you a minute ago about balance. When it's good, enjoy it. Be thankful. Thank God for it. But don't get too out of balance. So when the bad comes, when the difficult time comes, that you don't lose your faith. That you lose your confidence in God. Brethren, it's a very easy thing. I have gone to the homes of brethren who have suffered great personal tragedies. And they lost their faith in God. How did it happen? Because they allowed their faith to waver. You know what you're going to find out about yourself in life? You know, your faith in God is not determined. They're not really stipulated when it's good. That's really not when you're going to find out how strong your faith is. You're going to find out how strong your faith is when your faith is tested. When it's put to the test. When you have adversity. When you have trial. When you have tribulation. That's when you're going to find out how strong your faith really is. And you know what? I can tell you from personal experience, sometimes what you find out is very disappointing. Because it teaches you how shallow your faith really is. You know, why does God tell us to prepare for storms? Because He knows that they're coming. And we need to prepare ourselves for those storms. You know, Lynn Anderson made a bunch of money on a song called that I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. And you know what? God never promised us that either. He said that we would get a package deal. But the benefit is, if we accept the good with the bad, and we don't lose our faith, and we don't lose our trust in God, in the end, we win. Because we gain a victory in Christ. That's much better, no matter what we suffer here. No explanation for the obvious. Just man perishes in his righteousness. It happens every day. It happens every day that, you know, it's hard to say goodbye to a good person. A person who encouraged you. A person who edified you. A person who tried to live for God. A person that tried to do good for others. And he has some adversity in his life. And it ends up taking his life. That's hard to understand, isn't it? It's hard to comprehend why that happens. But it does happen. And then you have wicked men who seem to live long. They seem to live longer than the righteous, and their lives prolong, and they just do more wickedness, and they have more prosperity. And we look at that and we think, you know, what's up with that? That just seems unfair. Well, here I'm here to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, life is not fair. God never promised you a fair life. He promised you justice. He promised you mercy, and He promised you grace. And that's what He'll give us if we'll trust Him. Danger to be envious of the wicked. You know what? Everything is not what it always appears to be. You know, ladies and gentlemen, when you look at people, you're just seeing a part. You don't know what really goes on in that person's life. You don't know what underlies all that. You're just looking at the window dressing. You don't really know what goes on in that person's life. You don't know what difficulties they have. You don't know what hardship, and you don't know how their life really is. You don't know that. And so we need to learn contentment. We need to not judge ourselves by others. We need to be appreciative of what we have and understand that it's a blessing of God. Christians should never be discouraged. In the end, it will all be made right by God. It will all be made right by God. Example. Ahab, Jezebel, and Naboth. Remember? Ahab wanted Naboth's vineyard. He didn't want to sell it because it was part of his inheritance. And Ahab came home pouting about it. And Jezebel said, what are you doing? He says, oh, I offered Naboth a good price for his vineyard and he won't sell it to me. He says, who's king? Who's the king of Israel? He says, you don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. And so when Jezebel made up this little scheme, she had false men come up and give a banquet and put him in the front, and then had men, a base character, come in and make a false accusation about him and charge him with things that were heinous and had him put to death and murdered. And after he was dead, she came back and said, Ahab, go take your vineyard, it's yours. So he went over there to get his vineyard. He's all happy. Who meets him over there? Elisha. You remember what he told him? He said, you see this blood of Naboth right here? He says, your blood is going to drip right down. The dogs are going to lick it up. And you know what? That's exactly what happened to Ahab. And Jezebel's fate was even worse than that. You see, God made it all come out right. You've got to trust God. God knows what He's doing. You've got to trust God that in the end, everything will be made right. You know what? There's a lot of things in this world that really anger me because it hurts good people. I'm angry at what they do because of the pain that they cause. But I take great comfort in knowing that one day they will have to give an account to God. And that wrong will be righted. That gives me a state of mind. And that's how we should live our life. We're going to have times that it's good. We're going to have times that are bad. We're going to see times when men are treated correctly, and we're going to see times when men are treated unkindly and unjustly. We can't do anything about it. But one thing we better never do is let us destroy our faith. Trust God. It will all come out in the end. God will make everything right. You know the one thing I know, but more than I know anything else, on the day of judgment, God's not going to make one mistake. He's going to give everybody exactly what they've deserved and earned in life. Nobody is going to get away with anything. Please take your song books out and turn the song that Brother Mel has selected. Thank you for your kind attention tonight. We need to keep things in proper perspective, ladies and gentlemen. True wisdom can be found in placing wisdom in the hands of God instead in the hands of men. Life presents us with choices, and those choices can be helpful, they can be hurtful. Let us use the experience of our lives to make us better people, not to make us worse. You know, when God tells us certain things, He's telling us because He loves us. He tells us because He's trying to protect us. And you know what? We understand this, don't we? When you were a parent and you were raising your children, didn't you tell them things that you were trying to protect them? You were trying to protect them from harm. You were trying to protect them from things that could happen to them in life. They didn't understand, but you did because you've been down that road. Well, you know what? Nobody knows and has the wisdom that God does. And when God says something that there's danger in it, you better take note of that. And when God says this is a better course, you better take note of that. And when God says that this course will lead you to destruction, you better take note of that. Because God knows what He's talking about. And we have to trust God. And the key to living life is not to get too high, not to get too low. Find the balance. And God can help you do that. If you're here and you're not a Christian, we encourage you to consider your life and your decision. And we encourage you that you need to obey the gospel, not to please any man, but to please your Father in heaven and to have a relationship with Christ. That won't take away every problem in your life. That won't mean you'll never have a problem again. That won't mean that you'll never have a difficulty again. It doesn't mean you're not sin again. But it does mean you won't have to go through life alone. And when you make a mistake, you can correct it. God will forgive you, and you can go on, and you can prepare yourself for an eternal home with God. If you are a Christian and you've wandered back into sin, and you've left your first love, He hasn't given up on you. Your brethren haven't given up on you. All you need to do is turn away from the sin, acknowledge it, repent, and God will forgive you. If we can help you do either one tonight, we've been to the top four together. We can do these things.